Lecture 21, When Personalities Become Toxic.
Throughout this course, we have focused primarily on normal variations in personality. Although being high on a particular characteristic might be a bit better or worse for a person overall than being low on that characteristic, such variations are generally not terribly problematic. Of course, all of us have aspects of our personalities that can cause problems for us and that we wish we didn't have. But most of us nonetheless get by and function okay, even with all of our quirks. But some people's personalities create real problems for them. Certain patterns of thought, emotion, and behavior are associated with a high degree of psychological distress, create ongoing problems in people's lives, and make it very difficult for people to function across the important domains of life. We call these particularly problematic and dysfunctional characteristics personality disorders. I want to distinguish the kinds of personality problems that I'm going to discuss in this lecture from the problems of people who are mentally disturbed in the sense of hearing voices or having hallucinations. Those sorts of problems, such as schizophrenia, aren't really problems with personality in the way we're talking about it. What I'm going to talk about are people who are in touch with reality, as most of us know it, but who have problems functioning because of aspects of their personality. Of course, there isn't a clear line that separates normal, flawed personalities that we all have from personalities that are truly disordered and maladaptive in the ways I'm going to discuss. As we have seen, personality characteristics are on a continuum that runs from low to high levels of a trait, and there's no point where we can draw a line and say that you're fine if you're on this side of the line, but you have a disorder if you're on the other side. Even so, psychiatrists, practicing psychologists, and social workers need to make that determination, and they have formal diagnostic criteria that they use to decide whether someone needs treatment. We'll use their diagnostic system to talk about personality disorders, but we're going to discuss the problems in looser and more general terms. Many people show signs of having these problems, even though they technically wouldn't qualify for a diagnosis of having a personality disorder. So for our purposes, it's better to think of these disorders as maladaptive patterns of personality rather than as clinical diagnoses. So what is a personality disorder? And what makes a personality disorder different from the garden variety of personality problems that we all have? A personality disorder is a rigid and inflexible pattern of behavior that a person displays across a wide variety of situations and that leads to ongoing problems and distress in key areas of the person's life, particularly work and social relationships. Let me explain what I mean. First, when I say that a personality disorder involves a rigid and inflexible pattern of behavior, I mean that the person displays a particular pattern of behavior much of the time, even when it's not appropriate for the current situation. In most cases, it's not that the behavior itself is abnormal. In fact, that particular behavior could be quite normal under certain circumstances. The problem is that the person acts that way most of the time. The pattern of behavior occurs across many, maybe most situations, even when it's inappropriate. And it occurs over long periods of time, showing that it's a stable personality characteristic. Let's take the behavior of being distrustful and suspicious about other people's motives. Sometimes there are good reasons to be suspicious. There are situations in which being distrustful is entirely appropriate. All of us have been suspicious and maybe even a bit paranoid at times. It's entirely normal. But suspicion becomes a personality disorder when a person is chronically and unreasonably suspicious, even when there's no reason to be. That's what I mean by a rigid and inflexible pattern of behavior. It's as if the person's stuck in a personality rut that he or she can't get out of, at least not for very long. Second, to qualify as a personality disorder, the pattern of behavior has to be self-defeating. It has to interfere with aspects of the person's life and consistently create problems of one kind or another. Personality disorders typically compromise the person's well-being, and they usually make other people unhappy as well. So, to use the same example of distrust, although occasional suspicion is often beneficial, being consistently distrustful of other people makes the paranoid person unhappy, it upsets other people who feel falsely accused, and it interferes with the quality of their relationships. The person seems to have a disorder rather than just normal suspicion. And third, personality disorders tend to get worse when people are under stress. So although these disorders are a problem much of the time, stress increases and amplifies the dysfunctional pattern. In the case of paranoid personality disorder, for example, stress makes paranoid people even more distrustful and suspicious. The manual that mental health professionals use to describe and diagnose psychological problems is called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. You'll hear people call it the DSM. The most recent edition of the DSM recognizes 10 personality disorders. But there are other problems that some researchers classify as personality disorders that don't appear in the official diagnostic manual. As we talk about these disorders, I suspect that you'll be able to think of people you know or that you knew in the past who fit many of these profiles. Estimates are that in any given year, around 10% of adults would qualify for a diagnosis of at least one of these 10 personality disorders. And many more people would show the general disordered pattern of behavior, but it wouldn't create enough of a problem in their lives for it to meet the diagnostic criteria. So I hope that learning about these disorders will give you some insight into the personalities of some of the difficult and troubled people that you deal with in life. Let me say one other thing before I talk about these disorders. When we cover these problems in my classes, some of my students invariably start to worry that they show signs of one or more disorders. It's like the first-year students in medical school who think they have symptoms of many of the diseases they learn about in class. You may indeed show signs of some of these disorders. But if you do, keep something in mind. Almost everybody behaves in these ways from time to time. Under the right circumstances, most of them are perfectly normal behaviors. It's only if a person shows them continuously across many or most situations, and in situations where they are inappropriate, that we would consider them a personality disorder. Remember that it's usually not the behavior that's the problem, but the fact that the person is behaving that way when it's not appropriate. Personality disorders are often classified into three broad clusters that involve dramatic, emotional, and erratic behaviors, behaviors that reflect excessive anxiety, and eccentric behaviors and distorted thinking. In this lecture, we'll consider the dramatic, emotional, and erratic cluster, which includes four disorders: the antisocial, borderline, histrionic, and narcissistic personality disorders. These disorders are grouped together because they all involve problems with emotion regulation and impulse control that have negative effects on other people and on people's social relationships. We'll start with the antisocial personality disorder. I'm sure that you've heard the terms psychopath and sociopath. And I suspect that when you hear these words, you think of a crazed, axe-wielding maniac, probably chopping down a door to attack a bunch of teenagers in some bad horror movie. Well, that's not really what a psychopath or sociopath actually is. And because those labels have connotations of axe murderers, we now use the term antisocial personality disorder to refer to what used to be called psychopathic or sociopathic personalities. At the broadest level, people with antisocial personality disorder regularly disregard and violate the well-being and rights of other people. The disorder is characterized by two main things. The first is unemotional callousness. People with antisocial personality disorder are rather cold-hearted people. Not so much in the sense that they get pleasure from hurting other people, although that can happen, but rather because they simply don't care about other people's well-being. They show very little empathy for other people, and they rarely feel guilty when they hurt somebody. They often don't consider the impact of their behavior on other people, and they really don't care if they happen to do things that hurt or disadvantage somebody else. And if that's not bad enough, their disregard for other people is accompanied by impulsive antisocial motives. What I mean is that when they get the urge to do something that's mean or illegal or aggressive, they impulsively do it without much regard for rules or norms or laws. So they lie and steal and cheat more than most people do. And as I said, they don't really care about how it affects other people. So in their dealings with other people, people with antisocial personality disorder tend to be pretty irresponsible and undependable. They're the kind of people who don't follow through on what they say they're going to do, and they certainly don't apologize if their irresponsibility screws you over. They're usually a bit indifferent and detached emotionally, with an edge of intolerance and impatience with other people. Now, you might wonder how people who act this way can face themselves, but they usually feel okay about it. In fact, they usually see themselves as free and autonomous people who are not foolish enough to go along with a bunch of silly rules and laws when they don't want to. And they think that the rest of us are dupes for following the rules and behaving ourselves. One way to think about a person with antisocial personality disorder is in terms of the major personality traits that we've discussed previously. They have a particular configuration of traits that makes them pretty unpleasant. First, they consistently score very low in agreeableness. They're cold, unfriendly, and unkind people. They're also very low in conscientiousness. They aren't responsible, dependable, or organized. They're also very low in neuroticism. Now, that normally sounds like a good thing. Nobody wants to be neurotic, right? But a certain amount of negative emotion helps keep our behavior in line. People who are very low in neuroticism don't worry much about things. And not feeling much anxiety or guilt or fear or remorse allows antisocial people not to feel bad about the things they do. And finally, they score very low on the trait of honesty humility that we talked about previously. I mentioned that people who are low on this trait are very selfish. In fact, some of the items on the scale that measures honesty humility look like indicators of psychopathy or antisocial personality. So when we put this configuration of traits together, we have highly disagreeable and selfish people who are not conscientious or worried about things, and who don't experience guilt. That's not a great combination. Fortunately, people with full-blown antisocial personality disorder are relatively rare. The best estimate is that only about 1 out of 100 people would meet the diagnostic criteria for antisocial personality disorder. Perhaps not surprisingly, a higher percentage of those people are men than women. Of course, many other people show subclinical signs of being antisocial. Whether they meet formal diagnostic criteria or not, you really want to avoid people with antisocial personalities. The borderline personality disorder is just about as problematic. The label borderline is a bit strange, and people sometimes wonder exactly what this disorder is on the border of. The answer is that it's not on the border of anything. It's called borderline personality disorder because back in the 1930s, when it was first recognized, some psychiatrists thought that it fell in between being a neurotic disorder, which involves high anxiety and negative emotions, and a psychotic disorder, which involves loss of touch with reality. In fact, that's not true. So many experts are trying to get it renamed. A better term that more accurately describes the borderline personality disorder might be something like emotion dysregulation disorder, or maybe unstable personality disorder, because its central feature involves strong emotions and rapid mood swings in which the person loses control. So at one moment, the person is interacting easily and happily, and then a moment later, they have lost it in a fit of extreme anger or panic or despair. The things that trigger these strong emotional outbursts tend to involve perceiving that other people are being dismissive or rejecting. People with borderline personality disorder are exceptionally sensitive to signs of criticism and disrespect and rejection. And when they perceive that others are criticizing or disrespecting or rejecting them, they overreact, lash out at other people, and sometimes behave in vengeful ways to get back at the person. Then, when they calm down, they act more or less as if nothing happened until the next incident. Their reactions are rather paradoxical, though. People with borderline personality disorder very much want other people to like and accept them. But their reactions to signs that they're being negatively evaluated or rejected leads to extreme overreactions that cause other people to avoid or reject them. They want people to accept them, but they continually drive people away. Let me stress again that the behavior itself is not all that unusual. Many of us lose it every now and then over something that really doesn't matter very much. But we don't do it several times a week. It's not our typical way of responding to disagreement or conflict. Only about 1.6% of the population is emotionally unstable enough to meet the diagnostic criteria for borderline personality disorder. Being in a relationship with someone with borderline personality disorder is quite a roller coaster ride. People with borderline personality disorder often idealize potential friends and lovers at first. They insist on spending a lot of time together and share very intimate information about themselves. But then they can switch quickly from idealizing the other person to devaluing him or her when they perceive that the other person doesn't care enough about them or doesn't give enough to the relationship or is not there enough for them. You can see the rejection and abandonment theme emerging. For those around them, their partners, children, coworkers, friends, if they have any, people with borderline personality disorder are pretty maddening. You never quite know which person is going to show up on any particular day. The nice one who seems reasonably normal and accommodating, or the vicious one who's out of control. And even when the person is acting perfectly fine for a while, other people walk on eggshells, worrying about when something will trigger the borderline person's next outburst. The central feature of the histrionic personality disorder is chronic and excessive attention seeking. Wherever they are, whatever they're doing, the histrionic person wants to be the center of attention. So they monopolize the spotlight in most situations. Of course, most people like attention from time to time. But if you are never happy unless you are the focal point of every social interaction, then you have histrionic tendencies. Histrionic people have a very dramatic and lively conversational style. They act like everything they say is very important, and they tell their stories with a great deal of flair and emotion and exaggeration. Everything is a big deal. People with histrionic personality disorder also seek attention by being flirtatious and sexually provocative. That's one surefire way to get attention. Histrionic women in particular tend to, shall we say, underdress. There are places in which wearing revealing clothing might be perfectly acceptable, maybe even normative. But dressing that way to go to a funeral or the grocery store or your child's school picnic in order to be the center of attention might indicate a rigid pattern of attention-seeking behavior that characterizes a personality disorder. Sometimes new acquaintances find histrionic people's enthusiasm and energy and openness charming, But these characteristics wear thin after a while, when histrionic people continually monopolize social interactions. In a conversation, people with histrionic personality disorder tend to ignore what other people say and continually bring the focus back to them. And when they aren't at the center of the action, histrionic people may do something dramatic or outlandish to create a scene and get the attention back. After the first few minutes, they're not very enjoyable to interact with, so others often try to avoid dealing with histrionic people. Histrionic people don't seem to realize any of this. They generally think of themselves as sociable and charming and entertaining. They think they're the life of the party. And they tend to think that they're well-liked and that their relationships with other people are closer and more intimate than they really are. Histrionic personality disorder can be really annoying and socially disruptive, and it often interferes with the quality of people's lives. But it doesn't have the strong negative effects on other people that the antisocial and borderline disorders do. So the 2% of the population with histrionic personality disorder usually gets along okay in life, particularly if they are in professions in which their vivaciousness, flamboyance, and exhibitionism don't seem too out of place. The entertainment industry has more than its share of histrionic people, and you can probably imagine who some of them are. The fourth disorder in the dramatic, emotional, and erratic cluster is the narcissistic personality disorder, which is pretty much what it sounds like. The central feature is an excessive sense of superiority and self-importance. Narcissists overestimate their positive characteristics and see themselves as special, and not just in a particular domain. They think that they are special as people. In fact, on measures of narcissism that are based on self-evaluation, they endorse statements such as, "I think I am a special person," and "I am an extraordinary person," and "I always know what I'm doing." That sort of self-superiority and arrogance is annoying, but the worst thing is that people who think that they are better than everybody else also think that they are entitled to be treated special. Now, in particular domains, that might be true. If you're the best person at work, maybe you deserve a better office. And if you're the best athlete on the team, maybe you deserve some extra respect and playing time. But if you think that you're special as a person, then you walk through life expecting people to treat you special all the time. And that kind of entitlement often disadvantages other people. In fact, people who show signs of narcissistic personality disorder tend to disregard other people's views and rights. If I'm so great and special, I can do what I want, and I don't need to be concerned about the rights of lesser people. And narcissists tend not to feel badly about this inequity because they tend to be low in empathy. They don't care that their self-centeredness and sense of entitlement hurt other people. When you first meet narcissists, they often make a very good impression. They're often charming and confident, and they usually have pretty good social skills. One study asked research participants to rate the personalities of people who had scored high or low in narcissism after meeting them for the first time. The participants rated the people who had scored high in narcissism as more agreeable, conscientious, open, competent, entertaining, and well-adjusted than the people who had scored low in narcissism. Narcissists made a very good first impression. But as the participants interacted with the narcissists for a longer time and got to know them better, those rosy evaluations disappeared, and they rated the narcissists far less positively. It doesn't take people too long to realize that narcissists are full of themselves, have a sense of entitlement, and treat others as just an audience for their own self-aggrandizing show. But here's perhaps the most unsettling finding. The narcissists whom the participants rated most positively at first ended up being the ones who managed to exploit other people most successfully in the long run. I know what a cliche it is to say that you can't judge a book by its cover, but in the case of narcissism, it's certainly the case. Narcissists who make the best first impressions are the most dangerous. By and large, narcissists come across as calm and confident people. In fact, they're so confident that they often seem indifferent to whether other people like them or not. They're often very nonchalant, even when things aren't going well. But now and then, when the facade crumbles and they feel that they're under attack, they sometimes exhibit what's known as narcissistic rage. They lose it and overreact, and they might even seek revenge on people who put them down. In the mind of a narcissist, other people should consistently approve of, adore, and agree with them. After all, if I'm genuinely a special and superior person, then other people should recognize my specialness and defer to my superior intelligence and judgment. Much of the time, a narcissist can dismiss any negative reactions they get by simply concluding that other people are stupid or poorly informed or envious or just losers whose opinions don't count anyway. But now and then, those defenses break down, and the narcissist becomes enraged by the unfairness of other people's indifference or disrespect or criticism. We all get angry when we don't think we get what we deserve, and narcissists get angry when they don't get the adoration, respect, and deference that they think someone as special as them ought to get. Historically, there have been two competing views of the effects of parenting on the development of narcissism. One view is that having parents who are not sufficiently loving and warm creates narcissists, because children who have cold, uncaring parents try to compensate for feeling unloved by telling themselves how great they are. So from this perspective, narcissism is a defense against feelings of insecurity and being unloved. The other view says, no, narcissism arises when parents evaluate their children too positively. Parents who think that they have an exceptionally special child convey that viewpoint to the child, who believes it and becomes narcissistic. This has been a hard question to resolve because it requires following a large number of parents and children over time to see what kind of parenting is associated with narcissism. Parents who lack warmth, or parents who overvalue their child. A study just like that was published in 2015 that clearly showed that narcissistic people tend to have parents who overvalued them, who thought they were unusually special. So children seem to acquire narcissism, at least in part, by internalizing their parents' inflated views of them. I want to stress that I'm not talking about parents loving their kids. That's great. You can't give your child too much love. I'm talking about parents who believe that their child is a rare and special individual and who convey that judgment to the kid. Interestingly, the same study that showed that parental over-evaluation predicted narcissism also found that parental warmth and not parental over-evaluation seemed to lead to greater self-esteem in the child. This finding supports the idea that narcissism is quite different than just having very high self-esteem. True, narcissists score exceptionally high on measures of self-esteem, but there are plenty of people with high self-esteem who don't show any signs of narcissism. Just over 2% of the population meets the criteria for a diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder. But again, lots of other people who wouldn't meet the official criteria are still quite narcissistic. So we've covered 4 of the 10 recognized personality disorders: antisocial, borderline, histrionic, and narcissistic. Some researchers have suggested that in some ways, these 4 disorders are more of a problem for other people than they are for the person him or herself. But I'm not sure that I agree. Certainly, people with all of these disorders often impose on, take advantage of, and hurt other people. But all of these disorders are associated with patterns of behavior that undermine the quality of people's own lives. People with antisocial personalities often end up with legal problems for aggression, stealing, or not paying their bills. Their irresponsibility creates problems at work, and their cold-heartedness creates relationship problems. All four kinds of people create problems in their interpersonal lives and struggle to have close, warm, supportive relationships with others. So they often don't have the same level of social support that other people have. Yes, all of them affect other people negatively. But each of these disorders also has implications for the people themselves.